Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Political in this life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket, you'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. Every single thing. And on today's show, we're going to be discussing those politicians and people that are working for you, and those that are working against you. And just because you've been a Democrat or a Republican your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there that are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you speak to them. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to let you ask them questions. We'll be discussing the education system, the military, sports, science. What about that Pacquiao and Bradley? Give me a break. We'll be discussing health care. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are you 26 years old and still on your family's health care plan? Or as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We're going to bring it, let you know what the last word is on everything, from the cities, the counties, the states, the entire nation and the world. So sit down, get a pencil, piece of paper, and take this hour as a classroom experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson. Thank you, Count Basie. Yes, it's live from beautiful Charlotte, North Carolina. It's June 15th, about 3 minutes after three. I just came back from my hometown, New York City. Had a, as my aunt said, it was a day of the day. Now, let me explain this. It's because that I had to go to the doctor. I went to the doctor when I was there, and she went with me. And what we did from there was we visited all the graves of our relatives that we could. We had to travel out to first, we went to the farthest point first, which was Riverhead, New York, out on the island, about 70 miles from where I used to live in East Elmhurst. So we traveled out there, and my father is buried out there, and my aunt's husband, my cousin, he's buried out there. So we had to fudge around. It took a long time because that place is huge. That's Calvinton Cemetery. And so we saw both of them, and then we had a little bit of a bite to eat. And on the way back, we had to see my cousin, the Major. My grandfather, the Major. Sorry. If he could hit me, he probably would hit me right now. The Major. I want to tell you something. I found out that the Major, my grandmother, is buried with him in Pine Lawn, which is closer in to the city. It's still out in Long Island, but I'm looking over the grave, and it says Private Neville T. Miller. Now, this man was a private when he got out of World War I, but when he finally retired, he was a major. this is a major mistake. No wonder I've been having angina. He's been telling me something. So I need to check. He was with the original 369th that fought with the French during World War I. Because blacks could not get a weapon to fight because they were told they were not good enough. And that's a story that I need to go into, and maybe when I get back, maybe just before Independence Day, we'll talk about that. The 369th, which is the most decorated fighting American unit in the history of this country, and you don't know about it. Every member of his regiment got the Croix de Guerre from the French government. The Croix de Guerre is equivalent to our Congressional Medal of Honor. I have my grandfather's in the drawer with the American flag. We'll go into that story. They fought with the French because they couldn't fight with the Americans. So General Pershing lent the regiment, if he was 369th, which my grandfather was in as a 16-year-old, just turning 17, and two other units to the French army, because the French were used to fighting with black soldiers because they fought with the Sinhalese units from Africa. So they weren't, and the Moroccans, they weren't afraid to fight with any black soldiers. But we're going to go into that. That's another story. But I tell you what, I mean, I have a great drink. Yes, I do drink. I had a great drink when I was there. I want to tell you, and I should have had it with me. I can't think of the name of the rum. Now, you can mix this drink with either rum or vodka, but how they make it is, now, they make it per glass, and they have a little shaker that's per glass, and you put it into a martini glass when you pour it out, and you take lime, fresh lime, cut it up into eighths, then you pour sugar on top of that, and then you put in about 4 shots of this rum, Brazilian rum, and you fill it up with ice, and you shake it, shake it, shake it, shake it, shake it, shake it. I mean, till your arm falls off, you shake it, and then you pour it into the glass. I want to tell you, that is the perfect summer drink. And I had, I won't say how many rum, but I also tried the vodka. They are both good. Now, I want to tell you, you need to go out and try this on a day like this. Sit on the back deck. Have some. Try it. It works. It is delicious. But don't be driving after you have a few. Comprende? Yeah. So I had a few of those while I was there. Went to a Brazilian restaurant. And that was great. Jersey Boys while I was in New York. Great show. And it was just great. I had a good time when I was there. Doctor told me I was going to live for another year at least. So, you know, I'm doing quite well. And as soon as I got off the plane, my legs started bothering me again, sciatica. Anyway. Let's see what the story is going on today. The president just had a press conference. How about that? And during this press conference, this nobody interrupted the president in the middle of his speech. And the president, I'm looking at it right now, the president, you know, this stuff would not have happened if this man was not black. I mean, come on. I mean, let's be serious. Let's be serious. No matter how bad these so-called liberals were against George Bush. I don't remember anybody ever interrupting him in a speech that he made in the Rose Garden. I don't remember him ever being interrupted in a speech that he made in the Well of the House. I mean, what are we talking? These people are so disgusting and so racist because that's all it is. It's racism. Because he's black. This would not occur. Now, you know, the people are beating around the bush. They don't want to say it, but it is outrageous. And I'm saying it. It is racism. That's all it is. I mean, I'm so sick and tired of these people. These people don't care. They don't care. You know, they keep saying, yeah, John McCain was not born in the United States. He was born on a daggone territory. But he's going to slide? Romney, do we have his birth certificate? You sure he wasn't born in Mexico? Do we know what Romney has his money? He would even release tax returns. I mean, come on. It's mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. Here's a man. Here's a man who is, and I wasn't home. I wasn't at the studio where I could have. I was out today, so I didn't see this, so I can't tell you much about the interruption. But there, it's outrageous. They say it's just outrageous, and they expect Mitt Romney to even talk about it, saying that it was ridiculous. Okay, so. But even Geraldo's talking about it. That's how bad it is. So this is Romney, job creator, job creator. You think, Romney? It's just so incredible that. All he says is that he's a job creator. Does he talk about his role involved with Staples? You know, Staples, that large office supply retailer, probably the largest. You have a president, Romney says, who doesn't know business. When he talks about himself, he says, if I was president, you'd have a president who spent his entire life in business, small business, big business, and who knows something about how jobs are created and how we compete around the world. What does the Mr. fails to explain is his experience in eliminating jobs. This facet of his career is a particular challenge to the Republican front runner, or should say the Republican nominee. And tough business decisions do not relate to governing a country. I don't care how big the business is. You only have to deal with those people in your business. And you do not have to worry about someone dropping a nuclear weapon on your headquarters. You don't have to worry about sending 500,000 troops over to another country and making sure those troops have enough weaponry and protection to defend themselves. When he was the head of Bain Capital, Romney led the deal-making and selling companies. He bought and sold companies to make money for his company, not to make money for the companies that he was buying into. He didn't care about them. The bottom line is, what is Bain going to make? Whether they went to bankruptcy or whether they boomed, it didn't matter. Romney spent most of his career with Bain, and that's where he got his wealth from, over close to $250 million. Okay? And entrepreneurs and corporate founders, they create the bulk of the jobs, not financiers. Not financiers. Not corporate financiers, as I said. Not corporate raiders. That's not how they make their money. They go into businesses to see what they can make for their business out of that business. If they go into that company and see that they can make some money out of that business, then they go into it. They do not go into the business to save the company. What is so difficult for most of you people out there who think Romney is a savior can understand? Bain Capital is a corporate raider. They see company that has assets. And you know what the assets are? The assets are their pension plans. That's what the assets are. 90% of the, or 70% of the assets in companies are the pension plan. Can he go into that company, straighten it up for a few months, take money out, more money than they put in, and leave? They do not care whether or not the company folds or collapses. That is not their job, number one strategy. Their job is to make money for their own company. And he was working for Bain Capital. That was his job. All you got to do is go see Wall Street, Michael Douglas. They'll tell you what a venture capitalist does. Or, as they say, vulture capitalist. And they're proud of it. Hey, I don't knock them. But that doesn't mean that you can run an entire country. Because the entire country can, no country can be run like a business. That's why these people who kept saying, oh, we got to run the schools like a business. You can't run the schools like a business because everybody cannot fit into the same cookie shell. You've got students, if you have 30 students in a classroom, you've got 30 different ways to learn in that classroom. When you're in the military, you got one way to march. When you're in the military, you got one way to shoot a gun. You, when you're in the military, you got one way is to obey orders. That is not the case in education. We cannot pigeonhole people and say, okay, everybody in this classroom is going to go over to another school system, private school system, and you're going to pass because you're not learning in this environment. No, you're not learning in the public school environment because we're not giving enough money to teachers to learn how to teach in the 21st century. Schools are being taught, teachers are being taught like it's still the 18th century, where the only thing that they knew was farming. Today's teacher is more than a teacher. Today's teacher needs to understand, needs to be able to look at a student and tell whether or not the student is getting it. If the student doesn't get it, then the teacher needs to approach that student in a different way. But we do not give our teachers that flexibility to do that because they're all under one cookie shell presentation that they have to make in their classroom. Now, I taught for 9.5 years. So don't tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah, well, I never had more than 20 in my class. But every single one of my students had to learn a different way. Let's put it this way. 5 students, I guess, were visual. Some were oratory. I could just say it, and they understood it. Some had to write it down after they heard it before they understood it. So now how does a teacher go do this in a classroom where Mitt Romney now wants to cut teachers back and make it 40 to 45 students in a class? He has never been in a classroom his entire life when he went to school where there were 45 students in a class. Guaranteed, because he went to private school his whole life. We're not talking about a lecture hall in college where you might have 100 students. We're talking about elementary school and high school and junior high. I don't know about junior high. I never went to junior high. I went straight from the 8th grade to first year high school. But that was me. So I can't talk about me. But we need a different way to teach. It's not the school. We need to provide the means and the place for kids to sit in a classroom. But we also have to train our teachers with the 21st century direction of teaching. This is not your grandma's teacher. Grandma's teacher was great. But grandma's teacher didn't have television. They had radio. Or your great-grandma's teacher, that is. And that's a major difference in learning today. I used to tell the parents at PTA meetings that, hey, you know, your kids don't know how to listen. And they'd say, yes, you're absolutely right. I say, yeah, but, you know, there's a problem here. They don't know how to listen because you, it's your fault. They said, what do you mean it's our fault? I said, it's your fault. Because then they said, oh, no, no. I said, well, look, all right, no, really, it's not your fault. I'm sorry. It's your it's your parents' fault, their grandparents' fault. And they say, why? I said, well, there's one thing that your grandparents had that you didn't have and these children don't have today, and that was radio. Because when you had radio, you had to learn how to listen. You had to look, as I used to tell the students, you had to look at the words coming out of the speaker. You had to interpret those words. You had to understand what they meant. And today, we have television. And everybody knows that pictures are worth 1,000 words. So your interpretation is different than what it is when your grandparents went to school. They had to learn how to listen back then. Today, these pictures overwhelm our understanding of the words because the picture is what we see first and the word is what we understand second. So instead of understanding the words by creating pictures in our mind from words, we're now seeing the picture and creating a word from the picture, which can be very much confusing. It's just like the Kennedy-Nixon debates. The people who listen on the radio at the Kennedy-Nixon debates, the ones on the radio thought Nixon won the debate. The people who watched it on television thought Kennedy won the debate. Now, why is that? Because pictures lie if you don't know how to look at a picture. If you know how to look at a picture, you will be able to see and understand what they're saying. But most people don't know how to look at pictures. So the people who watched it on TV, they saw Kennedy. He was tanned. He just came from Florida. He had like 8 hours sleep. He was good looking. He had a TV white or blue TV white shirt on. He was clean. When the camera got Nixon, he was up since 5 o'clock because they were having major problems over in Europe. He had 5 o'clock shadow. He had a very heavy beard. His eyes were sunken. He was perspiring under the lip. He looked like a thug. So it didn't matter what he said. The picture ruined it for them. They didn't hear one word he said. So, let's now, since I've given everybody a debate, given everybody a lecture, which I'll go into some other time. But right now, we have a caller. Let's see who this caller is. Okay. Hello, caller. Who's this?
This is Leslie Dwyer.
Leslie Dwyer, how are you?
I am wonderful, sir. How are you?
Hi, one of our grassroots activists in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Leslie, you need to turn down your computer because
yes.
I hear it in the background. Okay, so how are things? Were you listening to what I was saying about teachers?
Yes, I was. But actually, you had me at creating nothing. I'm going back a chapter before that to Romney and financing businesses and not actually creating anything in the economy.
Absolutely.
That's true. It is. And I was trained as an economist. So... laissez-faire, hands-off, capitalism, etc. But even Milton Friedman thought there were such things as oligopolies. You know, two or three companies in the world controlling the entire market. And then when that happened, we had to protect ourselves with, I'm going to say a dirty word. Regulation. Yeah, that's right.
People keep talking about that, not to get off that subject, but we'll get right back on it, but people forget that you could not carry a gun in Dodge City when Wired was the marshal. I mean, these people say you carry guns anywhere. Let's carry them in church. Baloney. You're white in the wild, wild west. Wyatt Earp says, check your gun in my office or you don't come into town or I lock you up.
Exactly.
I mean, come on. What are we talking about here?
Well, apparently we need to
put... This is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for years. Check your daggone gun because you don't need it in town. Period.
You know, what people... I think are really ignoring is, and there's a good definition of this online on Wikipedia. I kind of hate this word, but it's financialization. When you look back at economics and supply and demand and a free market and capitalism, the cost of doing business, the cost to come together, if you, Michael, want to start a side business and go get a loan, you should be able to go get a loan. But they never imagined that our economy would end up being reliant 17% of our GNP is now wrapped up in that cost of doing business. Banking, fees, you name it. You know, you've got the spinning around right now. You've got the EU spinning around right now, and is Germany going to support the euro because they just need cash? And even the Wall Street Journal today said, but the euro is trading steady, which means it's not trading at all. You know, zero is steady. And 2 years ago, MasterCard Visa Corporation, they got called on the carpet for those pesky swipe fees.
Oh.
And those swipe fees, they voluntarily, they were about to get dragged through, you know, the broken glass. And so instead, they did a preemptive, tell you what, no Visa or MasterCard swipe fees in the European Union. And then they came back to the United States because, after all, in 2008, they knew they had made a mere $12
billion,
with
right.
a B, in the United States alone in 1 year just in swipe fees.
Well, now I want to tell you
something
that goes along that. I got rid of all my charge cards.
Amen.
I got one charge card. I got one charge card left. I'm paying off, and I told them to close it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a debit card. And I want to tell you something. So it was a month ago or 2 months ago. I somehow, because I have it automatically deducted out of my account. I don't know how I missed it. So I kept getting these calls. I said, but they're unknown. So I don't know. I don't answer unknown phone calls.
I'm with you.
So then I looked at I got a statement from them. And it said that I was over the limit, so it said like I owed them $170-something. So I said, what the heck is... So I called them up. He said, oh, yes, it was busy. You didn't pay last month. And I said, well, how did you get to $170? He said, well, we have your insurance that is on that. Then we have an over the limit, which was $35. And then we had because you didn't pay it on time, it was another $35, and then there was two other charges. I couldn't figure out what the hell they were. I said, I can't believe this. He said, that's why. Because it should only been about $70, so it was $100 more. So this,
do you remember
this
the phrase usury?
Outrageous. Huh?
Do you remember the phrase usury?
Oh,
meaning,
the mafia doesn't charge this.
Exactly.
The mafia don't charge this.
Hey, Sunshine, I'm actually an Italian woman. No, they don't. But usury, I mean, just because you're calling it a fee or a charge or a surcharge or... I have a zero-cost checking and savings account that I opened up at a bank, not one of the major ones here in town. And I opened it up in 2010, and in 2011 they changed the name and said, congratulations, you're now a member of Bright Beginnings, and that'll be $10 a month. There it went.
Right.
What for? I really am not that big of a drain on their resources, I assure you.
Well, for
a business like MasterCard Visa, when we know that is the framework internationally for moving money quickly and purchasing and keeping cash flow internationally, for them to walk into the EU just because they knew they had enough lobbyists here that they wouldn't have to sit down or slow down or do anything here. And no problem. No problem. So 17% of our economy is devoted to the act of carrying out business. That is not part of John Smith's invisible hand economics. That's the business development itself, the market itself that has created that. Now let's get into something a little funnier. You and I recently had a discussion of voting rights. Now the same two men that own the companies that make ATMs work in real time around the globe. With how many times have they been hacked? Do you realize? Yeah. Yeah, not much, huh? So, yes, internationally this works and has not been hacked, and yet those same two people are the only ones out there making electronic voting booths, and every time they've created something or sold something, it's had a backdoor hack on the way in. Now, that ATM network was up and running long before we were talking about voting electronically and voting electronic. Exactly.
And that's because that most people don't understand how this works. You don't hack Apple. Apple computers don't get hacked. I mean, so you know that when they say that, that's because they want it to be hacked.
Well,
they want a backdoor.
That's exactly right. I mean, the security standards are constantly changing. Just like your comment about teachers needing to have up-to-date access to technology. The way we communicate, were you on Facebook 3 years ago?
No.
Did you have any contact with any old high school friends, younger, maybe people you used to work? No, they weren't there.
No.
You know, this way that we communicate now has impacted so much. But the fact that we are not putting as much emphasis on holding people to the truth.
No, well, because the truth means that you can't lie. And what
I tell you what I want to do.
They lie.
Exactly.
I mean, liars can't help themselves. That's what they do. You can't be mad at a liar because a liar lies.
And that's
what they do. Don't be mad at them.
I'm sorry. I silly me. I've been listening to people in public office use the word transparency. And, kind of like the Princess Bride. That word, I don't think it means what you think it means. Because transparency, are you kidding me? A legislature that has to follow each other's Twitter feeds. Twitter feeds. Twitter feeds, and I was the first one in the Indiana Department of Commerce to have an email address on a business card.
Well, you know, I joined Twitter. I mean, I updated, put a picture on it yesterday. The people say, well, yeah. But 140 characters. I mean, I say 140 characters in 1 minute. I mean, it's too little. I mean, I get 250 emails a day. I mean,
exactly.
When do I? Then I have to now look at my Facebook page.
No.
I mean, when do I go to sleep? Hey, I go to sleep before that. I wasn't going to sleep till 1:30 and 2 o'clock every morning.
No.
So now I got to also check Twitter.
Oh, Sunshine, I haven't promised my therapist that I will not have a smartphone. It's you cannot come down at night and get a decent night's sleep if the last thing you do is have that attention span blitzkrieg that you have on social media. And if you like to read, or if you like to communicate, or if you're involved in topics like you are with politics or public policy or history with your grandfather, any of those topics are out there, and there's so much information, and oh, wow. And then the next thing you know, it's 2 a.m, and you're like, uh-oh. And that's another thing we have to do. Idea there is also a question of teaching people having a responsibility, and I think this is something that's going to end up falling more on like a League of Women Voters that we normally think of, a nonpartisan watchdog group such as that, and that is to say, let's point away from getting all of our mission information. I'm sorry, did I say misinformation? I meant to say information from individuals' websites, whether they're candidates, pundits, office holders, you name it. Mm-hmm. Instead of going there for all of our data, go read the bill. Look at ncledge.net. See what was introduced. See what they really said. Do they quote the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which actually the market listens to? The market does not listen to any of these political think tanks.
No.
You see, but you know, it's what I was talking about with Romney. He keeps saying this, that he was a businessman, a small businessman. He was never a small businessman. And why don't these people, these dumb, stupid, idiotic reporters, why don't they interrupt him like they have now interrupt the president? I mean, who the hell is Mitt Romney? He's a nobody. He's a nobody who ran away as governor because he knew he was going to be defeated. He was 39% in his final year. He's a coward who ran from the military service, but he's the first one to sit up there and wave a flag. I can't stand these people who wave flags. You know, the old saying is the last bastion of a scoundrel is the flag and religion.
Yep.
I am so sick of these people that talk about God and country but would not pick up a daggone letter opener to defend this country. They all have big mouths
like
Rush Limbaugh, Hannity, and O'Reilly, and Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
They had a chance to serve. We can't talk about people
who
did not serve.
He recently was on, I'm trying to remember that it wasn't Saturday Night Live or it definitely wasn't The Daily Show. But he was on a show where he just kept dancing around the idea of, people that have been continuously covered need to be covered, and we gotta do something about those No, that's not at all what he's saying. That's not what he's promoting. He circled it on national TV. Now with the demise of our printed newspapers and the bizarre current situation with how we get news, it's almost like some reporters have lost the ethical, the AP guidelines, the objectivity, and instead think that the one thing they have to do is make a name for themselves.
Yeah,
so
it's about a commentary. This is commentary.
It's about,
this is no longer news.
Trending on Yahoo. It's about trending on Yahoo. If you can get your name to trend upwards,
what the hell does that
you
mean?
Can get advertising.
Right. Hey, what does that mean? I'm looking at Yahoo. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean, trending? What does that mean?
A lot of people, before Google jumped into the Gmail account stuff, a lot of people had Yahoo.com email accounts.
I had AOL. I had AOL, and then I went to, who else I went to after that. But.
And then you had your other internet provider, and I had your current internet provider. But for me, I went with Yahoo, and that's just a timing issue that I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to get a free email account, and that way I can fire whatever internet carrier I want. And then what happens is they have a lot of news and everything, you know, and all running on the sides, and they want you to jump into their articles and whatnot. And so at the top of it, it always says, what's trending now? And that is like a live ticker of where the page hits are going that are coming from Yahoo. They can't measure everyone, but they can measure if you leave Yahoo where you go.
But how is that even reasonable? Because people who are not on Yahoo, I mean, and people who work for a living, are they? Now, I'm looking at my younger daughter. Every time I see her, she's texting something. But she's only texting her boyfriend. She ain't texting Yahoo. Give her an account. I mean, so who are these people that have all
there's
this
people
time
that
they
the internet
go there?
Well, for one thing, I got to say that when I was an investment banker, there was time when there was a lot of time when the screen saver was set to look like a spreadsheet, and I've got to.
Well, listen, I worked
do
on,
and read stories.
I worked on Wall Street. I worked with Payne Webber, Jackson and Curtis in the 70s. We were the first company to mark to the market. I was inside the trading room. I was one of the figures who figured every trade for the traders today. I was there from 6 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock every single night, and from Saturday from 6 o'clock to 12 noon. I have no time, if we did have a PDA, to anybody. So these people are not doing any job. They're not working if they have time to do that. It's impossible.
Well, and that's just it. But now a lot of what is going on is that in the gravy days when it was raining money, people could get away with screwing around. And it was less important. And the whole FaceTime thing was less important. In almost every working environment, first of all, you have to have kids to be allowed to leave on time if you are a first shift person. Now we have people afraid to step away from their desks at lunch because they're so concerned about the economy. We've got,
we go out for 2-hour lunches, especially on Friday.
Oh, it's
so
very
I don't know,
significant.
You know, what the hell is going on now? Hey, please.
Well, it's. I think part of the problem in Charlotte is the fact that we have a commuting CEO of the largest employer.
Yeah, well, that's
part of the issue. Is that creates a lot of trepidation, and all of those have contended on, even when you were working at the trading floor, there's a pledge class issue. You get them right out of college. You work them to death, and you burn them out. And that was pretty normal. Get them out of the big school and then burn them out.
Right.
And for those of us that weren't willing to live that way but also had not procreated, this created kind of a problem because they looked at you like you had three heads if you wanted to leave on time.
Hey, I did that thing 4 years. I said, this ain't going to work anymore.
Hey, you aged in dog years those years.
Please,
you aged in dog years that way.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
You know what's ironic, though?
See, and we did not have a computer. So every single trade, bond trades, over-the-counter, every trade had to be figured by hand, by a calculator.
That's right. Exactly right.
And I can't remember what year it was. We broke the record, but we were there. So we came in normally, come in at 6 o'clock. And we come in at 6 o'clock to balance the run from the day before because the vice president of Payne Webber Jackson every day flew out of LaGuardia with that run to headquarters, which was Boston, Mass., to present it to the board. So it had to be balanced by 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't balanced, then we had to give them a primary balance, which it was held to pay. So we balanced it.
You know, ironically, at that time, I'm going to wrap this back to education for you. At that time in the 70s, my father worked for RCA and was transferred to Taipei, so I lived in Taiwan. And I want to tell you...
I love that place. Love it.
Back then, yes. Now there's a bit of smog. But phenomenal, phenomenal time to be there. Just amazing.
I was
and,
there.
What year was this?
75 to 80.
Oh, see, I was there. I was there from 67 to 69, off and on,
yeah.
30 days at a time.
Well, the reason I thought of it is because I went to an American school. Okay, I went to a Catholic school. I went to an American school, but the Chinese kids, the Chinese schools, they were in school longer than their parents worked. They went in at 7 in the morning. They got out at 5 at night. They had a half day on Saturday, and because they hadn't been designed and entrenched by seasonal farmers, they went year-round.
Well, you see, now, and I'm, when I have a show, we need to have you back on the show. We need to talk about that because I always say, you know, what I learned when I went to elementary school, I went to Catholic school, and what I learned in high school, all that these same students have to learn, but everything that came after me in the same amount of time and in the same amount of days. Now, how is that physically possible? It can't be done. So what they do is they cut out civics, they cut out this, they cut out gym, and listen, you cut out music. They need to have music and gym to be an all-around person. If you don't have gym, you're a fat slob. The kids are
forget
dying.
That birth control, reproductive health, please. Let's not leave out the completely failed abstinence-only program, okay?
Even in Catholic school, they told us. When I went to school, they didn't talk about that. They said,
there's
hey,
nothing quite like having
you
a nun tell you to
pee. You actually did okay. What can I say?
There's nothing quite like having a nun teach sex ed, okay?
We didn't have sex education when I went to school.
To be health ed.
We had health ed. Now, we did have health ed. Had a half a term of health ed. And see, it was, I think what year it was, I think it was second or first year in high school, you split. You had health ed and you had gym. And then the rest of the time, you had gym. And then another time with gym and music.
Okay, aside from the fact that gym was my thinker grade in high school, right now we have some really scary statistics in this country with kids. We're talking about 12, 13, 14-year-olds who engage in oral sex because that's not sex. And, no one's talking about what is and isn't abstinence. And so there is, right now, the increase in incidence of oral gonorrhea among preteens. That just blew my mind. I mean, I get so blown away by that. I can't even talk the numbers. Yeah. My contacts just shot across the room. It's so stressful to me.
I am.
That's
sure.
Right. Preteens that, you know, we vilify someone like Planned Parenthood who's going to teach, okay, ABC, here's what's going to happen. And instead, we teach nothing. And so now we have not only that, but that same age group, and they've not yet proven a causal link, but that also leads to an increase in incidence of throat cancer.
Oh, listen. You know all the shows you had on in the old days, you know, Father Knows Best and Leave It to Be. They never talked about anything like that.
Oh, no.
Never did. Because it didn't happen. Mother was always dressed like she was going to the fashion show with her hair done and makeup on and high heels, and she had cleaned the whole house and cooked dinner and did the laundry.
Well, that's because her home did not rely on a full-time income from her in order to get her and her husband to a minimum level of the standard of living her parents had. Remember, I'm speaking on behalf of the first generation to not do better than their parents since the World Wars, since the Great Depression.
Okay.
And the impact on the family is something we are horrifically ignoring, okay? Because this whole idea that women are choosing to work, this all these attacks, you know.
How about the women that work? My mother worked. I do remember my mother not working. That's when she was explained, because we had the first TV. I was a kid with the TV in my class in the third grade. And my mother used to say, I invited at least five kids every Friday over to my house to watch television.
And spend the night.
And they would come over and we watch Peaky Lee. No, they didn't spend the night now. They didn't spend the night. And there was this gorgeous girl that I loved so much, my first love. Oh, Carol Ruff. And she lived across from me. And she would invite me over to her house on Thursdays to watch the diver in her goldfish tank.
Oh, dear.
I was so fascinated about this diver in a helmet spitting up the bubbles in the bottom of the goldfish tank. That was a lie,
my friend. You are there for the girl. You did not care about the goldfish. I know you better than that.
I'm telling you. Well, it was, you know, she was all right too. But when
we lived in Taipei in the mid 70s, we were there strictly because my dad was working for RCA and making TVs, and on Sunday night at 8 o'clock. The only American TV show all week long, Donnie and Marie. If Mom grounded you from Donnie and Marie, you knew you had really crossed the line.
Oh,
a week.
Donnie and Marie, give me a break. Oh,
purple socks and all. It was a simpler time.
Well, it yes, I guess it was simpler time. The thing is that when by the way, I want to tell you, you got me off the subject we were going to be talking about. But that's all right. Getting back to this goldfish tank and his diver. I want to tell you. Yeah. Carol was gorgeous. She was a gorgeous girl. I mean, to tell you. And I used to carry her books to school.
Sweet.
I would carry her books to school.
Now, Michael, you that sweet?
This was the first project that was ever built in Brooklyn.
Oh.
This was first. They were only, I think they were 4 or 5 stories high.
Mm-hmm.
We lived on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
She lived across the courtyard in the other project. But you see, they weren't like projects like we know projects today. They were more like apartments.
Right.
You know, they were, and they had a courtyard. And our school was at the end of, because it was all one facility. They had school right in there also. So
right.
We had to
walk
about
school and
300
yeah.
yards of school.
Mm-hmm.
And I would meet her out every morning. And I'd take her books and carry her books to school. And we walked together.
No.
So on Fridays, she came over to my house. And she would watch the TV. Thursdays, I would go over her house, and I would watch
the fish tank.
And her mother said, oh, yeah, mother and father, they bought her these different colored fish. I think they were the Siamese fighting fish.
And then she had some striped plus an angelfish in there, and she had these big goldfish that none of them fooled her. But so, and she Saturday didn't see her because she was Jewish, and they went to synagogue.
Oh, okay.
So on Sunday, sometimes their family would come over to my house, we had dinner, and then we go over to their house and have dinner. We were very good friends. And my mother and her mother were very, very close.
Oh.
And the thing is that I think because her father and my father got out of service almost around the same time, and we moved in at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So now that place is gone now. I went by the Osborne Street, and it's gone now. But it's been gone for years and years and years. But I remember that the teachers understood individuality and how people learn. I was a person who had to hear it, write it down, a class notes, and then get home and write it down again.
Mm-hmm.
I'd write all the notes.
Very visual.
Yes. I am a visual person. I had to see that, and I didn't. But you see, I grew up right on the cusp of radio and television, so it sunk into me that I could do both of these, and I understood how to do both of them. But I have a swollen index finger because I hold the pen when I write so tight that I created a lump on my hand. And the thing
yep.
right on the beginning
yep,
of the
yep.
index finger. So and the thing was that I always, because you know back in those days you had to do penmanship.
Write things.
Rip,
yeah, penmanship. And write it over and over. Yeah, we all have those.
I always got 95 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I was always either number one or number two in my class when I went to Catholic school. And
me too.
There was one kid, Stephen Current, I remember his name today. He was the smartest kid in the school. Forget the class. Smartest kid in the school. And that was the only thing I ever beat him in. I beat him about 5 times. He got A on every single thing he did. But I would get A+, or he would get a B, but I beat him in 10 minutes.
Now, I did that with mine was Jim Padgett. We rented our house just in a suburb of Indianapolis. When we moved to Taipei, we rented the house out and then moved back to the same house. And so I went back to the same Catholic grade school, and it had the same 35 people in my class. And they were all kind of looking at me like, that was you? Where'd you go? And I got back, and it was time for Sister Raymond to help us with multiplication of three numbers by three numbers, and we had to go up the board. And Jim Padgett just scared the snot out of me every time. By the end of high school, I had above a 4 point on a 4 point scale with 5 years of math, and I ended up doing statistics, mathematical modeling in my public policy program for my master's program. So, you know, you'd think I kind of made up for it on the whole math front. But oddly enough, in high school, Jim and I were also in the same typing class, you know, the one taught by the basketball coach. Who knew? Who knew back in the 80s that the most important skill I would develop and the skill that would earn me the most income would be typing? Because I have fed myself so many times in between jobs or after college, as a temp, you know, just learning new, you know, you learn the new version of Word, then you learn the new version of Excel and everything. But I got to tell you, being able to type by 80 words a minute is not something that I thought was going to be my mark on the world by any stretch.
Well, listen. Well, you know, see, now that means you must be fast on the computer.
Hell yeah.
Well, you see, now, see, I need you to come over here and do my work.
You got it.
Listen, I never learned how to type because I took an academic course in
mm-hmm.
high school. So typing was in the commercial
right.
course. I took an academic
trade.
Course. So
yeah,
I did
right.
not. Well, no, not that the trade was vocational. Commercial course
okay.
was if you're going into business, you're going to be an accountant. You were going
right.
into statistics. You're going
yeah.
into something that had to do with the math, the adding, subtraction, a lot of bookkeeping, things like that. Academic was, you're going to be a nuclear weapons physicist. Or I'm a nuclear weapons physicist. But, you know, aeronautical design, which I did do. I went into design aviation. But anyway, but the thing is, so I never took that up. So when I first got my computer, it was unbelievable. I said, I got a type. Holy cow. And I was looking for every single way. And I bought these daggone these programs where you could talk to the computer and type for you. That was
oh, yeah.
Anyway, but now the ones are really good. But
what you were saying about having to do all of those calculations on the trading floor, I just watched a great documentary about the women who were called into help with the math in World War II, with trajectories for bombings. You didn't have computers. That was a lot
oh, yeah.
of math to do.
Oh yeah, well the English are the first ones to really do that because they're the ones that developed radar, and they had the women who were working on the floor. Figuring all that out. They had a lot of women who were working for SOE and MI5, MI6. So, you know, which was SOE back then. But,
that whole body of mathematics, if you look at in World War II, they also developed a body of mathematics that was used to help the military deploy the submarines in such a way that they would be the most effective.
Well, yeah. You know,
move them around.
Movie.
And you have
the
to...
It's
a bunch of equations because it's about... it has to do with, you know, how fast, how slow, how long you have to wait, how, you know, speeds, rate, distance, all that.
Right.
That
but
same
see,
math... went into business in the 60s, and so it helped. It was reapplied. It was called operations management or research, operations research. And it wasn't until the 80s that we started using that same math, and now we could do it in the 80s faster. We had things like SAS out of Raleigh. Well, wherever over there, the triad. And you had different companies like that that allowed you to crunch enormous amounts of data that these women in World War I had to have a room full of them to do one problem. We could do problems, you know, 10 in an hour. And that mathematics, it's the same thing that if you look at, for example, when you go to the bank versus going to the grocery store, they have two different kinds of lines. At the grocery store, you're looking around and jockeying and convinced you're always picking the slowest line, right? And if you're at the bank, you all go in at once and then first come, first serve. And that kind of mathematical modeling for processes is real important for things like what's the optimal number of copies of a particular title of book for the public library to have? Or what's the best way to, what's the most efficient way to address cats' needs and usage needs? So there are all these things that we can dive into earlier now. I'm looking at kids in junior high doing algebra, which I loved it, but, you know, it's horrifying to people.
Well, yeah, but you're a nerd, so what the heck?
Yes,
no.
Amen.
So that has, so, you know, you can't compare those things. But I was getting ready to say, I mean, there were things like where we used, you saw the movie, have you seen the movie Battleship?
No.
You heard about the movie Battleship?
No, I'm sorry.
You are a nerd. Anyway, so the thing is,
I've never watched Titanic. I know how it ends.
Anyway, well, the movie Battleship, we used to play that in high school on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's what the movie's about. And really, you know, you put spaces down. There's only so many spaces in a certain area that you can have, and you can make the spaces small. You can make the spaces wide. If you know how large the spaces are, then that's what you give your ship to, wherever it is. So this is something that they used all in World War II. You know, there's nothing new. And that's how they were able to
is the general, game theory is
right.
What
right.
would
right.
be
game
most
theory.
It would be the umbrella
Absolutely.
Term. Yeah.
So the thing is that figuring out, which is what they did realistically with the radar in World War II, they put the sky in boxes and they knew where they would be, and they would know the coordinates, and that would be the end of the story. But what you're saying about math is absolutely true. But now, speaking about math, it doesn't add up when you take a getting back to Mr. The Mr. Romney, when he's talking about his credentials for job creation, because the nation is faltering, he has never, ever, ever shown that his purpose to go into a job was to make that job better.
That's right.
And
to improve
the chairman
earnings.
Of Bain Capital, his main focus is to make sure that Bain Capital does better, not what he is buying into to become better. As long as they get what they put in and they profit out, it don't matter where that company sinks or swims. Now,
that's right.
You can't do that in the United States government. You can't sell off assets and then expect to say, well, don't worry about it. We'll just sell off stuff. And it will go where it does. Let the economy go where it goes. That's the same thing he said about the car company. Hey, that's what he said about the people who own houses. Hey, let them go bankrupt. And then the people will come in and buy it up, and then we'll have more people buying. No, it don't work that way in the United States. It might work that way. It don't work that way with a country of over 300 million people. It might work that way with a business that had 10 or 20 or 30 or 40,000 people, but not 300 million. And especially when you need an army to fight a war.
You know, you have hit on something that, congratulations, put on your Nobel Prize in Economics hat. Our recent winner is Joseph Stiglitz, and he was in the Clinton administration. And I have to say, sadly, that the last step before walking out the door was that the Republican Congress was allowed to pass the repeal of something called Glass-Steagall. And if you, again, Wikipedia, best description. However, remember in the old days when a bank was, you know, the place down the street where you taught your kid how to save for a Christmas club account and dog got a biscuit at the drive-thru? That's bank with a K. And at that time, I'm talking just a dozen years ago, bank with a C was the one that was dealing with deals you're talking about with Romney. Okay? Bank with a C was the investment bank. It was the guys you were working with on Wall Street. It is the smoke and mirrors. It's the complicated stuff, and it's not the stuff that widows and orphans should be dealing in. So there was a firewall between the two, and that way, if a community was trying to say, oh, I don't know, build roads, and they had a referendum, and they were going to have some debt, and they were going to build these roads, that's something that's straightforward. It's a government job, and we're not really competing with the private sector when we do that. Well, you know, if you're in L.A. and you've got toll roads, you are, but that's definitely not Charlotte's issue. And those deals needed to be separated. Now, I worked as a dual employee because I could do both kind, and my job was always to protect taxpayers. I was a financial advisor for our communities, cities, states, you name it. And it was the attorney that was responsible for us not going to jail because of that law. He and I became really good friends because the bankers that I was working with, they would lie about those numbers. To merge the two entities to look bigger and, you know, all that.
I want you to hold on to that thought for a minute because we got another call. I want you to stay right there. And we have on the phone a young lady who is running for the lieutenant governor of the state of North Carolina. And let me see if I can pick
her up. Candidate Coleman.
Hello, who's this?
Hello,
yes,
Michael.
Is this Lieutenant Governor soon, Linda Coleman?
This is she. How are you?
Yay!
How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm doing quite well, thank you.
We were just talking about some growth issues, and I know that that's one of your things that you're pushing is a pro-growth solutions for working families in the Carolinas. Can you tell us something about that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, North Carolina has been one of the high growth states for the past few years. And when growth comes and you anticipate growth because of the quality of life and other reasons, we have to plan for it. And we need to plan for it in a very positive way. And what I would like for us to do is to look at our state as a whole, not just the urban areas, but the rural areas as well, and look at the topography of our state and look at the emerging markets that are out there, and plan for those emerging markets. For instance, the area that you live in, and you've heard me say this before, you all were known, Charlotte Mecklenburg, for the financial industry for North Carolina. And with the pending merging of Duke Power and Progress Energy, which will create the largest utility in the entire nation, I'm sure that you all are going to be known as the energy industry as well. And, of course, energy is one of our emerging markets. There are going to be lots of opportunities in that area. There are going to be jobs that we haven't even begun to think of that will come about as a result of that. And so when we look at that, we also have to look at our educational institutions, because I don't think that you can look at any one thing in isolation, but you've got to look at them in totality and look at those kinds of things that really complement them. And education, economic development, you can't have one without the other. Everything from our community colleges, which will really provide the training for the workforce that some of these jobs will create, and they will need a quick turnaround. That's one thing. But then the universities will serve a purpose in terms of sustaining that kind of economic growth and having the curriculum there. So that would be the sustainability part of it. So
can you give us, I don't want to interrupt you, Linda, because you're on a roll there, but can you name us three of your priorities
Absolutely. It's hard to name just three, but I will tell you the top ones that I think about, of course, are jobs and the economy would be one, because that's the most pressing thing for all of us right now. You know, we've been struggling, and it's just really important that we get our people back to work. The second one is education, because, again, it's very difficult to separate education from the economy and jobs. And then the third one I would say would be workforce training, because if we're going to have the jobs, we've got to have a trained workforce, because no one is going to come to this area without a trained workforce. That just is not going to happen.
Leslie, you have something to
add? Candidate Coleman, amen to that. Economic development finance is kind of my thing. And one of the things that you referred to is just that Site Selection Magazine, for example, is the Bible, the Wall Street Journal for economic development in North Carolina, Charlotte, the Triad, constantly have been doing well in there. Now, the challenge will be with is that you've highlighted Charlotte, and I'm grateful for that in the energy sector as well, because neither of those are manufacturing entities, and yet most of the tools for economic development incentives or economic development evaluation, both of those are typically very, very biased towards manufacturing positions. The fiscal impact model to determine how much the state should give in an income tax credit if we want someone to locate here is unfortunately going to be very biased towards someone that's going to put a lot of bricks and mortar in. And so if the world economy is changing, and we're getting to the point where we really have to figure out how to go after the value-added jobs, the intellectual property jobs, but things like that, you're absolutely right. How do we do that without education? How do we do that without workforce training?
You cannot do that without those kinds of things. That's they all go together. You cannot have, they come as a package, and you are going to be missing the whole boat if you try to do one without the other. The other thing that we've got to do is we have so much talent, because right now we're going to have to start looking at talented people. And it's not just a job, someone who has gone to school and get a college degree. We've got to change the model that we've been looking at. But that's going to take some time, but, you know, we can do that. And when I say we need to change the model, I'm thinking about the competitive edge for us now is going to be how creative and innovative can our employees be in their jobs, because so many of the jobs that we do now can be outsourced to India, China, and other places. So the U.S. and North Carolina is right up there with as a part of this country. We have to have that competitive edge, which is that innovation, that creativity, to bring that. And then we have to look at the people who we educate, our homegrown people who are leaving North Carolina after we have invested so much into their education. We've got to learn how to identify our top talent, and we've got to make sure that we keep it here. How do we not just providing incentives to the companies, but how do we provide incentives to our young people who've got these bright ideas, who are smart people, who we need to keep here and not have them go off? I think it's wonderful when they can go to different places, but we need to offer them the opportunity to be here if they would like to be here.
That's right.
When you
talk about the looking at the topography of North Carolina and not just looking at the large communities, you know, we were excited that the Triad had the foresight how many years ago to put in all that fiber optics, which landed IBM and SAS and some of the greatest employers in the country. And
It took vision to do that and courage, and it took persistence, because you can have a vision, but you've got to be able to sell the vision. You've got to be able to get other people to catch the vision, and it takes courage and persistence, because the first time you say something, it may not resonate, but you've got to be able to show people. You've got to follow through with that and prove to them that this can be done. And, boy, has that RTP paid off for North Carolina. It absolutely has, over and over.
Let me ask you this, candidate Coleman. My thing is, and I've been told, that I shouldn't say it, but, the fact is, if we do not capture the daggone Senate and the House, it don't matter if Mickey Mouse was the governor.
You are absolutely
right.
You are so right. You know what? I will tell you, it is funny that you say that, because I am taking a break right now. They have just finished up the session I'm at the North Carolina Legislative Black Caucus Foundation weekend, and we have just finished with some senators and representatives here.
Yeah, I was supposed to be up there, but just came back.
Yeah, well, we miss you. We miss you. And they have talked about the absence of a majority and what that means, because I will tell you, it doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how many great ideas you have. If you are not in the majority, we are going to lag behind, and that's exactly what we're doing, because instead of moving forward, we're going backward. You can look at the legislation that has come out over the last almost 2 years, and I will tell you, it has really taken us back. We used to be known as a very progressive state, and now I will tell you, I shudder to think what people think of us now with some of the laws that we are passing. We just passed the fracking bill. I believe that was yesterday.
Is that right?
And, they still got the voter ID bill in queue waiting for somebody to be absent one day so they can override the governor's veto of that bill. The Racial Justice Act has been gutted. That bill has been gutted. The law has been gutted, and they are just turning that around. There are just so many things that we have got to turn around, and we cannot do that unless we start working toward getting our majority back.
It's not strictly Democrat versus Republican on the issues. The very first bill that this Republican legislature introduced, their first act in that General Assembly, was there's always a requirement to do kind of a mini bill, budget bill, which will finish out the fiscal year, because, we have these non-calendar year things. And this sucker this initial budget bill, this little tiny thing that didn't get a lot of press, it must have broken records for how fast it went through both houses, both hearings, boom. It is sitting on the calendar on Friday. It had been introduced prior Monday. The big thing in that bill was to remove $80 million from the governor's economic development incentive program. At noon, the local chambers of commerce found out about it, and then the bill vanished.
Leslie, let her answer.
We don't have time for any more. And let her answer. Isn't that the candidate?
That happens when bad bills do come up. If no one says anything, they go through. There's bad legislation on the books now. It just takes all of us to be very vigilant about what's going on, and it takes us talking to our representatives. Everybody, every citizen in North Carolina is represented by one state legislator in terms of a House of Representatives member and a state senator. And we need to talk to those people. They will answer you. They will pay attention to you because you are their constituent. And so we need to be letting them know how we feel about these things. And we need to make sure that we hold them accountable. That's what the name of the game is. It's accountability, responsibility, and accountability.
I have one last question to ask you before we go, because we got another caller coming in here. What do we need to do to make sure that we can take the House back?
We need to get out and vote in record numbers. If you're not registered, you need to register to vote. Because there are so many things. I just heard of the most eloquent speech by Representative Mickey Michaud when he said that as a North Carolina citizen, he has the right to vote. There should not have to be a voter ID because he has the right to vote. And I believe that 100%. But we've got to register to vote, and we just can't sit home. We've got to vote in every election. We had an election in Wake County a couple of years ago, school board, which ended up being a very partisan board, was elected by 3,000 people, just a little more than 3,000 people, and they tore up Wake County School Board. We finally got it back, so now we hope that we can get our educational system in Wake County back on track. But that is exactly what happened. So people have got to go out and vote. You just can't register. You've got to go out there and vote. And you've got to vote for the people who are going to represent your interests. And you have to vote your interests. You cannot be persuaded. You need to vote your interests. And find out what it is if you don't know what it is.
What's the website that we can donate and look up your information to your candidates?
Absolutely. And I do want to hear from everyone. Please, you can contact me at www.lindacoleman.org or just lindacoleman.org.
Do you have a?
They have my issues. You can donate. You can see the videos. You can see my responses. Interviews. All of my information is at lindacoleman.org.
Is there a phone number or something they can call a campaign headquarters? People want to come out and assist your campaign.
Right now, and that number is going to change probably in another couple of weeks. But right now, you can reach me at area code 919-834-8994, extension 526.
Okay. And I want to thank you, and good luck. And anything that we can do to help you move it along, just let us know.
Well, thanks. Let me say, while I have the opportunity to say this, I want to thank Mecklenburg County because you really did come through for me, and I appreciate so much all of the support that I have received, and I am always embraced when I come to Mecklenburg County, and I appreciate the hospitality from all of the citizens of Mecklenburg County. Thank you so much.
No problem. Anytime.
Hey, if you're willing
we'll
to run, we're willing to back you.
Thank you so much. And I hope you all have
all right.
a great evening.
You have a great time, too, this weekend. Are you going to go? But aren't they having something this weekend, the Legislative Caucus? Oh, no, the convention
yes.
this weekend.
Well, this today is the North Carolina Legislative Black Caucus Foundation Scholarship Event. Tomorrow is Jefferson Jackson. We start with a breakfast at 8:30. We have our state executive committee meeting convening at noon, and then at 6:30 or 7 o'clock we have the Jefferson Jackson dinner, where our keynote speaker is going to be Bo Biden, who is the son of Joe Biden. Right, and this evening our speaker is Congresswoman Marsha Fudge out of Ohio. Tomorrow morning our speaker is going to be Congresswoman Nina Turner out of Ohio.
Oh,
so we've got some great people coming to speak to us over the next couple of days.
Very good. Thank you for that. All right.
Okay.
Candidate Linda Pullman, Lieutenant
Thank
Governor
you so
for
much.
North Carolina. You heard her. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Leslie.
Oh, Michael. The state. All those powers not specifically granted to the federal government in the Constitution. Quit ignoring the state. We have to get the state back. That has more impact over the daily life than anything.
Right. Well, I want to... thank you for being our guest today. And
well, I am very grateful for your time and for your show.
Well,
so thank you.
We will be getting in touch. I'll talk to you sometime this weekend.
Sounds great. And
all
thank
right.
you. Take care.
Bye. So you heard from Linda Coleman, who's a candidate for lieutenant governor and would be the first. She might be the first female, definitely the first black female lieutenant governor. She knows what she is talking about. So I want to thank Leslie and I want to thank Linda Coleman for calling me. But, you know, I want to get back to the Mister. The Mister, he is the man. You know what the Regressive Party always says? We have to stop blaming President Bush for the country's problems because too much time has passed. That is so stupid. That's just like saying we need to stop blaming Osama bin Laden for the attacks on the World Trade Center, 9/11. I mean, it's past. What the hell are we talking about it for? Are we still blaming Hitler for causing World War II? No, because you know why? We paid to fix up Europe. So they forgot about Hitler. But nobody's paying to fix us up. We had to pay ourselves. So this blame game, when you have a moron, and that's what they are, morons, who can't think of anything else because they have nothing else to present. And I'm going to give a commentary on this, short commentary on this before the show is over. Romney has not told us one single thing that he wants to cut. Nothing. Not a thing. But let me tell you a few things about what this president has accomplished in improving the economy. When he first got into office, February 17th, the real GDP increased by 3.4% due to stimulus spending that he initiated. Then, the same day, and this is $82.2 billion in aid for low-income workers and unemployment retirees was included in that stimulus package for training, which caused us to divert from a deeper recession and depression. At the same time, 2.7 million jobs were added to the U.S. payroll. And unemployment was cut by 1.5 percentage points because of the stimulus. And then along came, Rami says, let him go bankrupt. Liquidation of General Motors and Chrysler was avoided through the government-mandated restructuring plans and conditional investment and loan programs. Oh, we only saved 115,000 jobs by doing that. That's all. 1.4 million American jobs were saved overall because, hey, if you're working in a plant of GM, that's not the only job that would go out of business. The trucker who delivers the parts to GM, you think GM makes the parts right there? No. The people, the trucker who would deliver those parts to him would be out of a job. The people who make the parts would be out of a job. But see, you know, these regressive parties, they don't talk about those people because that's ancillary, so they don't count. You know, it's almost like that movie Collateral Damage. Well, we got to kill him, but hey, it's collateral damage if somebody else gets hurt. $96 billion in personal income losses was avoided by the restructuring of GM and Chrysler. $96 billion! And then along came $28.6 billion in net public benefits and income taxes and Social Security paid because liquidation of GM and Chrysler was avoided. Social Security payroll tax credits in 2010 for employees that hired people who had been unemployed for 60-plus days. $17.5 billion in tax cuts, business credits, and subsidies for state and local construction bonds to stimulate business, investing, and hiring because of the stimulus that was passed. Financial Stability Oversight Council was established to identify and monitor the U.S. financial system, which was never done before. We put that in place. He put that in place. And then they put in the rules called the Volcker Rule, which these rules was told banks they had to be transparent in their trading and their credit default swaps and derivatives. I mean, they also got the FDIC bank deposit insurance to increase from $100,000 to $250,000. Borrowers were now protected from bad loans with rules and penalties requiring lenders to verify that they were able to repay the loans that they issued. I mean, $30 billion in lending programs were created for community banks with incentives to increase small business lending. On-job training opportunities expanded for veterans by reimbursing the energy sector employees for training costs. Veterans work study program expanded to include congressional offices and state agencies and institutions for higher learning. $186 billion in tax relief for all taxpayers by extending the Bush income tax credit for 2010 and 2011. $136 billion in tax relief for 21 million middle-class households. And that was patched to the alternative minimum tax that was passed in 2010-2011. $111 billion in tax relief for workers by reducing Social Security payroll taxes from 6.2% to 4.2%, a 2% drop that was done in 2011. And then it was extended again to go through 2012 for self-employed Social Security payroll taxes. And then finally, you know, well, not say you should say finally, federal unemployment benefit programs extended an additional 13 to 20 weeks. Now, what gives us, what tells us that Mitzer, if he was president, would have taken us from A to B? That's the first question. Now, as he keeps saying, well, whatever the president did, we would have done better and quicker. So what tells us anything in his background, the Mitzer's background, that would have assured us that he would have taken us from A to B quicker? It ain't going to happen. There's nothing. He has never done anything like this. So hey, you say, well, Obama never did anything like this. That's absolutely true. But Obama never said that he had done something like this before. Romney saying, I have done it for years. I'm a businessman. I know how things work. He's as much as a businessman as Donald Trump is a billionaire. Everybody who has a half a brain knows Donald Trump is not a businessman. That's the reason why he's not running for president, because he had to show his taxes to prove he was a businessman. Every time he comes to the altar, he runs away. Why? Because he's a billionaire on paper only. A billionaire on paper only. Romney probably has more money than he does. He's a billionaire, Trump, on paper only. Now, the problem with the Mitzer, he has improved Bain Capital, where everybody had to do what management said. This is not how you run a country that is diversified, with over 300 million people in it, and that has to fight wars, and that has a military force around the world. The only way it would require massive cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and other non-defense spending. Because he said he didn't want to cut defense spending. He wants to boost defense spending. Even Ronald Reagan realized by in boosting defense spending and not increasing taxes, you were creating a massive, massive hole. Ronald Reagan raised taxes 11 times. And none of these moronic, ultra, neocon, and I'm not going to say conservative because they're not conservative. That's bull. They are not conservative. They give conservatives a bad name. These are opportunists. Romney has never outlined the cuts in any specific program. But if policymakers exempt Social Security from the cuts, as Romney has slightly suggested, and then cut Medicare, Medicaid, and all the other non-defense programs by the same percentage, balancing the budget and adhering to a Romney spending cap will require cuts of 35% in 2016 and 56% in 2020, and that is from the Congressional Budget Office, a nonpartisan organization. Without balancing the budget, the cuts would be smaller, 28% in 2016. And 38% in 2022. That is also from the Congressional Budget Office. So I ask you, what are we talking about here? What are we talking about here? We're talking about someone who has never, ever ran a business that made anything. And my commentary this evening is just about that. No matter what is being said now, the regressive party wants you to forget about what happened under Bush 43. Why? Because the Mr. is Bush 43 on steroids. The Regressive Party jumps up and down every time liberals bring up that comparison, and for good reason. It's the same direction. The same shallow, deprived concept that brought this country to its knees and almost to a complete collapse. If John McCain had become president, this country would have been in the worst depression than it suffered during the 1930s. But this one would have been 10 times worse. Everything that we, the people of America, gained in working conditions for the facilities we worked in, for pay, health care, education, safety standards, such as food testing, the clothing we wear, construction sites, buildings, car safety standards, during the last 70-plus years would go straight out the window. You say no? Well, let me explain further. It took only 7.5 years under Bush 43 to go from a plus $230 billion surplus to a negative $490 billion deficit, a difference of negative $720 billion. It took World War II and 25 years to get us out of the Great Depression. So why, I ask you, why, oh, why are there so many stupid people, especially these Obama haters, in this country that think that just because we elected the first black man in the White House who graduated with a bachelor's in 1983 from a prestigious school like Columbia University and studied political science with a specialty in international relations and then went to Harvard, was selected as the editor of the Harvard Law Review at the end of his first year, and the president of the Harvard Law Review Journal in his second year, and then graduated J.D. magna cum laude from Harvard in 91. Just because of all that, did you really think that he could turn around this country's problems in less than 3.5 years? Tell me, what planet are you from? Tell me. Are you really that stupid? We all know this man is good, but he ain't no Houdini. What he did was turn around a bleeding $800,000 job loss per month under Bush 43 to over 4 million jobs plus in little over 3.5 years. More than 27 months of job growth. But Romney says that's not good enough. And this is from someone who never, ever had to turn around an economy that was fighting two wars simultaneously and actually never, ever had to manage a business. His business never sold one single product that wasn't paper related, that wasn't on paper, that you couldn't put on your head, that you couldn't put your feet into. It's all fictitious. It's in the air. It's money that Donald Trump has. It's the same money. When it comes to taking out of the bank, it ain't in the bank. It's in the things around it. So just remember. And I will be back with you next week. And for all you guys that want to hear the show over again, it'll be up and running later today. This has been Michael Love.